and welcome to Risky Business number 194. I'm Patrick van der Grey, I guess, if I'm here in South Africa. South Africa, I gotta tell you, it's sweet. It's sweet, bro, and just a little bit hectic. I'm in Johannesburg right now. I've been attending the IT Web Security Summit, where I did a talk earlier in the week. And I got to say, South Africa, what a country, what a couple of weeks I've had. Half work, half pleasure, so much fun. This week's podcast is brought to you by Astaro. Thanks, guys. And I don't know if you've heard the big news out there, but Astaro has actually been acquired by Sophos. So first, our sponsor NetWitness was acquired, and now Astaro. So it just turns out the companies that sponsor Risky Business seem to be developing a bit of a habit of getting acquired. So two this year. Happy days. Congratulations, guys. So before we get started on this week's show, a little bit of housekeeping to attend to. There's going to be no regular Risky Business next week, but that's okay, because I'll be posting something like 15 podcasts into the Risky Business 2, otherwise known as RB2, into the Risky Business 2 feed. So that's right, it is Aussert time again. I'll be down there covering all sorts of stuff, posting talks and interviews. So make sure you go to risky.biz/feeds and subscribe your podcatcher to the RB2 RSS feed. Don't try to find RB2, Risky Business 2. Do not try to find it in the iTunes store. It is not there. Find it at risky.biz/feeds. And our coverage of the Aussert event starts on Monday. On this week's show, however, this week we're having a chat with Parisa Tabriz from Google. She's also been here at the IT Web Security Summit in Joburg. She did a cracker presentation the other day on Google's approach to web application security. Google's also launched a bug bounty for web app bugs in their online properties, and we'll be chatting with her about that in a little while. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, in this first news item, apparently Anonymous reckons it didn't hack Sony, but some people affiliated with it, well, that might be a different story.
Well, yeah, and this is, you know, it's exactly the nature of Anonymous, really, isn't it? That, you know, if you want to be anonymous, well, you can, and you can go ahead and attribute your actions to Anonymous, even if you're not, you know, maybe that's what happened, maybe Anonymous... the DDoS attacks that Anonymous were actually carrying out were used as cover. You know, maybe it's just misdirection. Maybe it was the Chinese. Who knows? But yeah, this is, I don't think I'm particularly surprised with Sony coming out and saying that they thought it was Anonymous, and then Anonymous having a bit of internal argy-bargy about it.
But this whole idea of Anonymous being some sort of organization that issues press statements, I think, is actually quite funny.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, it is a bit ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, you know, anyone can claim to be anyone they damn well like on the internet, and I think that's you know, there's some people in the you know, traditional print media who are having some trouble getting their heads around that.
Yeah, I think too, there's like the Anon Ops crowd, which is like a group of people who like to attribute stuff as Anonymous. You know, they like to designate their actions to Anonymous. And they're actually having some internal strife at the moment. That's our next story, which comes to us via ZDNet Australia.
Yes, indeed. So apparently someone actually owned anonops.net and anonops.ru, which is two of the anonops sites to host their ISC and forums and all that sort of thing. And it's being attributed to rogue members of previous members of anonops or something like that. But anyway, much as you would expect from 4chan and Anon, you know, there's a bit of drama going on. Pretty much welcome to the internet, I think.
Yeah, I just don't understand how an organization that isn't actually an organization can implode. They found a way.
Yeah, it is a little bit surreal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, apparently, too, in this story, Anonops has now restored service to its forums and is advising all of its users to change their passwords. Ruh-roh.
Well, at least they kept their credit cards encrypted, right?
Yeah, we shouldn't laugh too hard. So, guys, Anonops guys out there, please don't own us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Bye.
All right, so moving on, and another bit of news that's kind of related to the PlayStation thing. Some guys actually found some IRC logs. I remember very early on in the story when the PSN network breach first bubbled up as a news item, there were, I think I first noticed it in a tweet by Mikko Hipponen, which is this guy like Trickster or something. talking with some other dudes in IRC were basically in the IRC channel PS3 Dev. They were talking about all these sort of vulnerabilities, like about how Apache was out of date and blah 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 blah. And so, of course, when the network got popped, people turned around and started saying to these guys, you know, oh, well, obviously it was you. But one of them, Trickster, is actually a guy who's been in prison before for hacking-related stuff that, you know, he turned out later to be pardoned for. His name's Brett McDaniel. Yeah, this is an interesting one. He's come out and basically said, yeah, no, it wasn't us.
Yeah, and I suppose anyone who is, you know, gives any credence to those logs has obviously never hung out in a, you know, security-related IRC channel. Because, I mean, people posting, you know, what they saw in an Apache you know, server string header and an HTTP request, that's pretty normal. And, you know, the particular version of Apache they're running, right, doesn't appear to be remotely vulnerable to anything. And it's just a, you know, general indicator that they're not up to date on their patching, which, you know, that just says things about Sony's general posture, or at least the difficulty in maintaining a very large production network and keeping it patched. And, you know, it's a very, very long stretch, in my opinion, to go from there to these are the guys who hacked it. So, yeah, it seems a bit bullshit to me.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch. McDaniel was the guy, I don't know if you remember this was in 2003. I think I covered it for ZDNet at the time, which is he was the guy who blew the whistle on some shitty security at his company. So he actually emailed all of his employers' users and said, you know, your information is at risk. And he wound up going to prison for that for about 16 months. And then there was an appeal, and the Justice Department wound up filing a confession of error, conceding that he hadn't committed a crime. So, you know, this is a guy who gets the finger pointed at him a bit.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I guess that's, I mean, that story itself was particularly bizarro. And yeah, you would think the guy would, you know, think twice about getting involved in, you know, actual proper hacking for a change after that experience.
Yeah, but I don't think he was involved in much now. I think he was just like hanging out in IRC going, oh, look at that. They're using like a 2-year-old version of Apache.
Yeah, well, like everybody else in the freaking industry, right?
Sticking with something related to whistleblowers, some guys who blew the whistle on some crappy security at Boeing, they actually went to the media over some pretty spooky stuff they saw internally, and they were fired. Turns out the courts, this is according to Wired.com, courts have ruled that firing those guys was okay, because while the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 would have allowed them to go to authorities with their concerns, it doesn't allow them to go to the media.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty sensible finding. I mean, if I went to the media every time I reviewed a customer and their shit was shitty, you know, I'd get fired every week. So, yeah, you know, I think if you're going to be an auditor, then, you know, having some degree of respect for your confidentiality agreements is probably a pretty good move in terms of the longevity of your career.
But doesn't it depend to the extent, you know, like how egregious the horror that you're seeing is? I mean, and if they're just refusing to address it, like, so, you know, if you were auditing a really critical bit of infrastructure, but I suppose, yeah, I mean, go to the authorities, not the media. And, you know, I say this being in the media.
Well, exactly. And the first port of call certainly would be to go and talk to, you know, the government body responsible for critical infrastructure or whoever, at least first, before you go and talk to the media, at least if you, you know, expect it to go well for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I do find something horribly wrong and I go and talk to the authorities and they don't do anything about it, then yes, I'll give you a call. Don't worry.
Yeah, you go to the media when the authorities fail, basically, where the last line. Oh, now, God. God damn. According to CNetNews.com, I mean, Facebook, occasionally just you find out about the most awful, awful, awful stuff that gets plugged in Facebook. And apparently, yeah, they just plugged some sort of bug that would have allowed third parties pretty much unfettered access to anyone's profile. Yay.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. So when you have apps and things in your Facebook, or you're using apps that integrate with Facebook, they can request a temporary auth token to use to, you know, log into your account and post wall posts, whatever the Facebooky things that Facebooky apps do. And they could, apparently using a legacy API, request basically a permanent offline token that never expired. So normally you'd expect a temporary token like that to last for, you know, minutes or hours or whatever, but apps were able to request a token that lasted for, you know, indefinitely, and then some apps were leaking those tokens via GET requests rather than via POST, and so they'd be turning up once again in the logs of all the other, you know, third party content were referenced off that page. So there's not only the apps themselves can gain permanent access to your account, but then also all the, you know, analytics providers and advertising providers, and every proxy in between and all that sort of thing, all those sort of boxes have access to that token and, you know, potentially have the ability to now own your account for the rest of time, which does seem like a fairly poor design choice to me.
Yes, it does seem a little bit unorthodox, shall we say. A little bit strange. Perhaps, you know, when they whiteboarded it, they thought it seemed like a good idea at the time, that sort of thing. But tell me, do you know what sort of access these tokens allow third parties? I mean, is it just a case of these tokens will allow them to do certain things like post on a wall? Or can they read messages, go through chat logs, things like that? I mean, what sort of access was being leaked here?
I'm not sure what the if it is the full set of activities or not. I mean, I guess I don't use Facebook enough to really to understand the depth of, you know, how the innards of their authentication work. But it does appear that the credentials can be used to do pretty much anything you would care about, and they can do it, you know, as I said, for an unlimited period of time and when you're not otherwise logged in.
So, but either way, it's bad.
Either way, it's bad, yes.
Okay. Now, this is an interesting piece, and I really wanted to get your thoughts on this because I'm not sure that I've wrapped my head around it 100%. Apparently, there's some research. This is a story by Stephen Shankland over at CNET also, who says that WebGL graphics pose some sort of security threat. And I don't really know much about what WebGL is, let alone how it's going to pose a security threat. Can you walk us through this issue?
Yeah, so WebGL is basically a standard, it's an extension for HTML5, which allows you to write JavaScript and HTML that will use the 3D rendering capability of your graphics card. So you can do, you know, 3D accelerated graphics in the context of a web page. And the way that it does that is by using the OpenGL language, or a subset of the OpenGL language, which is called WebGL. So basically, you can, you know, craft WebGL programs. I mean, these days, modern graphics cards are, you know, fully featured programmable devices, and the OpenGL code you run is effectively a Turing complete programming language. So effectively, what you have here is a web page being able to load executable code into the GPU. And the GPU runs in a very privileged context in the sense that it's a piece of hardware and that its primary point of communication is a kernel space driver. So any bugs in the stack of WebGL, the operating system graphics libraries, the kernel space driver from your video card vendor, and the video card itself have the opportunity to screw up. And one of the objections that people have made to WebGL is that it opens up areas of technology in that stack that have never been exposed to untrusted input before. Specifically, I guess we're talking about the graphics drivers and sort of the kernel space interfaces of those. I mean, that's not something we've ever really worried about being exposed to attackers before, other than hardware accelerated 2D rendering rather than 3D. So there's a couple of attacks that the context guys have talked about. One is denial of service. If I load a piece of code onto your graphics card, which just tries to render a really large amount of things, then your graphics card may lock up, you know, effectively sit in an infinite loop, because there's no real way to stop graphics shader code running once it's started. And the result of that is not that your browser locks up, it's that your whole damn operating system can't draw to the video card anymore, which, you know, is not a particularly good outcome. Apparently, some versions of Windows will automatically reset the graphics card after a couple of seconds, which is still a bit suboptimal, but on Mac OS and Unix and older Windows, you basically, you know, you either get a blue screen or a hard lockup. So the denial of service aspect is interesting. The second area, which is probably much more interesting in the long run, is what else you can do by running code in the context of a graphics card. And the demonstration that these guys are talking about is using graphics card code to leak the state of things being drawn to other web pages. So if you have a web page that's rendering, you know, your banking in 3D because your bank is very hip, then perhaps a piece of malicious code that's also rendering to the graphics card can leak the state of the image buffer back out again, which is, you know, a novel, you know, maybe a little far-fetched at this point, but certainly a novel attack.
Yeah.
And we will definitely see a bunch more of things that we'll be able to do as this progresses. But it's, you know, much like we've seen with the, you know, the increase in complexity of web stuff over time with plugins and font rendering and, you know, 2D acceleration, now 3D acceleration. It's just, you know, exposing areas of the stack to attack that previously, you know, haven't really been considered security critical.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like fascinating research by these guys, context information security. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's got any immediate applications that are real world, but it looks like, wow, this is an interesting area of research that I'd imagine people are going to pile into. Now, I wanted to ask you too, say you could actually somehow just like root the graphics card, take control of the graphics card. Would you be able to get memory access over the bus? I mean, can you take it to that level?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't know enough low-level graphics programming to, really say conclusively whether it's possible or not. But it certainly seems plausible, depending on the flexibility of the graphics card and the bus access and things.
Yeah, it's fun stuff anyway. But you're right. You know, I think any bank that's rendering its customer information in 3D, that is indeed quite hip. That's very Web
4. Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it doesn't seem like an immediately plausible threat, but certainly if you were, a risk-averse sort of organization, then turning that shit off now and waiting the 5 years for it to, kind of solidify a bit would probably be a wise choice.
I'm calling it now, by the way, listeners. When banks start rendering customer information in 3D, we've officially gone way past Web 2.0, way past Web 3.0, and I say at that point we'll be at Web 3.4.
Wow, that's quite a prediction you've made there.
I know it's bold. I know it's controversial, but I'm prepared to make that prediction right here. Web 3.4 coming soon to a banking website near you.
Web 3.4. With virtual queues and everything.
Apparently, some French researchers have demonstrated an attack against Chrome, which bypasses DEP, bypasses ASLR. Looks pretty cool. And these guys are kind of known for selling bugs to, the people who tend to be buying them these days, which isn't necessarily, Tipping Point and all of those iDefense and whatnot. So, yeah, looks kind of interesting, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, so the video of the exploit was pretty impressive. It's a workable, functional exploit against modern mainline Chrome on Windows. It pops shell and bypasses, as you said, DEP and ASLR, and also breaks out of the Chrome sandbox, which is, that's quite an interesting exploit. We haven't seen one of those in a little while. And the fact that Chrome was left standing at pwn2own suggests that the value of that bug, is more than the pwn2own bounty was. As you said, VUPN are definitely in the business of selling this sort of thing weaponized to governments and mil and that sort of crowd.
And they haven't disclosed this to Google either, and Google are being quoted in this story. A lot of news from CNET this week. They seem to have we obviously had last week off, but there seems to be a lot of really good news on CNETnews.com of late. But Google is quoted here as saying, "We're unable to verify the claims. Should any modifications become necessary, users will automatically be updated, blah, 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 blah." But basically, they've just said, look, it hasn't been reported to us, so we can't really do anything about it.
Yep, and that is the way that the industry is heading these days. These bugs are too valuable to give away for free.
Yeah. Look, Patch Tuesday has rolled around again, and this time only a couple of holes. So, compared to the monster or 64 patch, whatever, that we saw some time ago, this one looks like a pretty pretty chill one.
Yeah, a bit less drinking this month, huh?
Yeah, not as much drinking. But what were the bugs? There was one critical, wasn't there, in Windows?
So there's a critical bug that's potentially remote code execution against the Wind service. That's the whole kind of legacy Windows name resolution thingy, which I imagine most people who don't have Windows 7 everywhere are probably running.
Yeah.
So that one is definitely worth patching, especially on your domain controllers. And then I think the other one was bugs in PowerPoint. Office suite bugs are, you're probably pretty used to patching those, so you get to it.
Go forth, patch. You might want to patch your Skype as well if you're a Mac user, because some guys down in Sydney there from Pure Hacking, they found a bug that was an exploitable bug for Skype on Mac OS X, which means anyone sort of in your address book can own you, which is not so good.
Yeah, so it's not quite clear from the posting on Pure Hacking exactly what the bug primitive is, but yeah, as you say, it does sound like it's some kind of remote code exec bug, and the fact that they are suggesting it's wormable, makes it sound pretty trivially exploitable. Although, of course, it is mitigated by the fact that you have to be able to send messages, which requires that people are on your contact list. But I mean, I guess the connectivity graph for people on Skype probably would lend itself to being wormed pretty well, huh?
Yeah, and in my job, I have one or two shady people that connect to me via Skype. One or two shady so-and-sos in my Skype address book. But apparently, Skype said that at the time Pure Hacking alerted them to the issue, they were already aware of it and they were working on a fix. So they're like, grumble, grumble. We knew about that one. Grumble.
Why don't you patch it then, jerks?
Yeah, exactly. Sticking with some sort of Mac news here, and it was a matter of time, but it looks like there's a fairly decent-looking port, of all this this rogue AV stuff for Windows that's made the bad guys, an absolute ton of money. Look, it's moved to Mac, and the guys at Intego who get so excited, I think these guys make Mac security products, and they get so very, very excited when anything comes around that that appears to target Macs. But this looks like something that could actually take off. Tell us all about it, Adam.
Yeah, so I mean, it's pretty much your common garden rogue AV sort of thing. And if you run Windows platforms, I'm sure you're probably familiar with how the scam works. But in this particular piece of malware, it's called a Mac Defender. And apparently, it presents a fairly convincing looking fake AV program and then pops up porn sites in your box and kind of does things to make you believe that you have a virus and then sends you off to the payment form to encourage you to buy their product. Their fake product, and you enter your card details, and then all of a sudden all the porn pop-ups and virus warnings go away, successful commercial arrangement carried out. And of course, you can't help but think that, despite this looking like a scam, and as you say, they're not being a whole bunch of Mac malware, so Mac users not being quite as used to, buying antivirus products. The sad thing is this probably will work pretty well. It works on Windows, and the Windows ones look... have all the same sort of things, and it appears to work on that platform. So, I guess some Mac users are going to get sucked in, lose their credit card, lose their money.
What's funny is it's going to be the ignorance of some Mac users that's going to save them, because they go, "Puh, this is obviously a scam. My computer is impervious to viruses. Steve Jobs has shielded it with his magic,
Yeah, it's invulnerable.
His magic cloak.
Yeah, the cloak of Steve.
But what is funny, though, is that they are still serving Windows screens. It's actually the graphics of Windows screens with animated images showing the malware scan. So they haven't actually got around to updating the graphics for it yet. But the application itself, once it gets onto your Mac, it's actually quite well developed, they say. So really all they need to do to make it 110% finished is just update those graphics. And apparently an update as of May 5 by Intego on that blog post says that they have discovered several new variants of it. So it is actually getting out there. So people are actively working on it. We'll just have to see if it sticks.
Well, yeah, I guess, the Mac as a platform still has a long way to go to catch up with the, the sheer amount of malware on DOS and Windows boxes. But, maybe we'll get there eventually, with a bit more market share.
Now, this next story just vindicated a decision I made a long time ago, which is I wouldn't use password aggregators, and password storage services. But LastPass, which is one of those online sort of will store your passwords for you services, it's been bonzerized in what I can only assume was some sort of irony overflow or something. I don't know.
Yeah, so the LastPass story has been kind of interesting. They blogged a couple of weeks ago now, or a week ago now, about something weird going on in the network, and everyone should change their passwords. And they went through a process of forcing all their users to change the master password that encrypts their cloud-based password storage. but at the time they were not particularly sure that they had got on. They saw something weird, they were a little, paranoid. And it does seem like that maybe they were a little too paranoid, because they haven't really come out and said that they've got any idea what's actually going on, and quite possibly nothing's going on. But a whole bunch of their users are pretty upset with their password reset process, and apparently there are some technical difficulties with it. But I guess it's a good example of how to take this a little too seriously rather than the more laissez-faire approach we've seen from the other sort of cloud providers.
So they weren't bonzerized?
Well, they don't really know. They haven't come out and said that they were or they weren't. They said they saw something weird and they're not sure, but they're going to make everyone change their passwords anyway.
Not even a little bit bonzerized?
Maybe just a little bonzerized.
So I guess I should just cancel the echo on that, right? And just make
No echo on that one.
Pwns or us.
Pwns.
Okay. All right, moving on. Last story for the week. And an ATM hacker in the United States. This guy found some user manuals for some common ATMs, used default password hacks to convince it that it convince them that they contained $1 notes, not $20 notes, which, you know, it's the old scam. He planned to hit like 35 ATMs, pull out about $200,000. He actually pulled out about $8,000 using a prepaid debit card, which was kind of the special sauce in this attack. But unfortunately, one of his the guy that he tried to enlist in this scam rolled on him, and now he's in prison. Rutroll.
Yeah, well, it sucks to be him. It was a shitty scam to start with. Although, on the other hand, you really got to say,
how is that like, a shitty scam? Hang on, come on. That's a pretty good scam, man. Come on.
Well, I suppose, I mean, a couple of $100,000, yeah, that would be all right. But the fact that he's in jail makes it a shitty scam.
I don't think it makes it a shitty scam. I think it just makes him a shitty criminal, to be honest.
But no, I mean, really, you know, to what extent is typing in the manufacturer default password really hacking in the year 2011? You know, that's just incompetent sysadmin being, being exploited for gain rather than hacking.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to disagree with that. And Adam, that's actually the end of this week's news, mate. Thank you very much for joining us for our, you know, truly, I mean, we're normally transcontinental, but now we're really transcontinental this week, mate. Thank you very much for joining us, and I will chat to you again in 2 weeks after AusCert.
All right, cheers, Pat. I look forward to try not to get eaten by a lion, huh? We don't want to be reporting bones or eyes by lion.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. It's time now for this week's feature interview with Google's very own Parisa Tabriz. She did a presentation just the other day here at the IT Web Security Summit in Joburg, all about Google's approach to web application security. Google offers all sorts of risky services. I mean, look at Gmail, for example. I mean, that's a service that previews and renders stuff like PDFs, PPTs, Word documents, all sorts of risky file types. I guess they're a little bit safer because they're a bit of a black box. But they even host applications for their users. It's very brave work. Late last year, Google started offering a bug bounty for flaws found in their online services, which is quite novel. So I thought I'd have a quick chat to Parisa about that. I started off by asking Parisa to tell us all about her talk.
So I talked about three of what I consider are some of the distinct approaches Google takes towards fighting and fixing web security bugs in our web apps.
In a nutshell, can you describe what they are?
Sure. So the first way is we try to make fixing of cross-site scripting vulnerabilities automatic by introducing context-aware automatic escaping in all of our templating systems. The second approach is we handle user content hosting across all of our apps by using sandboxed domains so that even cross-site scripting vulnerabilities introduced by browsers or plugins, any of the web environment our users are using, have low impact because they can't actually be exploited. And the third way is actually not a technical approach, but more of a cultural, philosophical one, where we try to actively work with the community via vulnerability reward program and contributing to open source projects.
Well, we'll get to that vulnerability reward program in a moment, but I would think that securing an environment like Google's online properties would be quite challenging because of the level of interaction you guys have with your users. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, definitely. It's challenging. Google, as a company, really strives to innovate quickly, and this means we want to put something out. Our founders have even said, you know, we want to fail quickly and improve quickly. And if you launch something that doesn't have problems, you probably launch too late. So in such a rapidly changing, evolving, innovating environment, it's hard to get security, right? It's a challenge. Yeah.
So, I mean, what sort of content are you looking after? You're looking after everything from code on Google Code. You're looking at stuff like video. Are there sort of more active content types that you have to look out for that your users are sort of submitting? I mean, where is the most interaction between users and Google that could get you into trouble?
What do you mean by user interaction?
Okay, so like Salesforce.com, for example, right? They allow third parties to submit applications to plug into their code, right? To actually interact with Salesforce.com. You know, if I upload a video to YouTube, I mean, that's not particularly interactive. But do you guys have like online development platforms and things like that that people use that you really have to be extra careful about?
So similar to actually Salesforce platform, we have something called Google App Engine, which allows users to upload Java applications and Python applications that are running in our production environment. So,
I mean, that's already making a lot of people out there who host that sort of stuff go pale with fear right now, because I imagine that's a hard thing to lock down.
It's a completely hard thing to do. When the App Engine team approached security team saying they wanted to do something like this, I think we saw a couple of faces go white. But, you know, it's an incredible thing to be able to offer to users. And our team worked very closely with the App Engine team to, you know, do sandboxing and auditing and kind of limiting of APIs that we would support for developers. It's a scary thing, but, you know, it's also, I think we made it possible and are reasonably confident that it's hosting user applications is safe. And we haven't noticed any incident, you know, since launch with that, so...
Well, I love that quote there. Hosting user applications is safe. And I think we're going to have a photo of you and put that quote on it just in case something does go wrong. Have you had any oh-my-God moments since you've been over there? Have you had some stuff go sideways? I mean, of course you would have. And I imagine it's not stuff that you'd necessarily put a press release out about, but you would have had some pretty scary moments. Can you talk about any of them?
Well, so I guess probably the most public one is this Aurora incident, which has gotten some attention.
Yeah, but I don't think the people who did that were doing it by uploading, you know, applications to run on your public properties.
Yeah.
I mean, really what I'm more talking about is not someone necessarily owning your office environment, but someone actually owning some sort of Google service by interacting with that service in a malicious way.
So... we've gotten some scares. So with respect to App Engine, these all run in sandbox environments, and all of the alerts will page someone on our team. And, you know, anytime you get a page, it's sort of scary because you got to figure out if this was some false alarm or if it was a legitimate, you know, sign of exploitation. Happily, none of the sandbox alerts that we've gotten have actually been a result of external, you know, compromise, but some bug, and we've been able to kind of trace it down and investigate and realize that it's some kind of developer bug. So we've been lucky with App Engine, and you know, you get a oh my god every time you get a page and an alert, but yeah, it's nothing that comes to mind that I can think of evidence of mass compromise.
We'll just see how that pans out over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, yeah.
With everyone getting owned the way they are. You mentioned this bug bounty program that's actually designed to encourage the submission of web application vulnerabilities. And I know some large online properties are sort of moving in this direction, but you guys are actually offering to pay people if they find bugs in Google's, you know, online services. Is that right? Have I got it right?
Yes, exactly. We have all the rules posted on our security blog, but essentially, you know, Google's welcomed people to hack responsibly on our web apps, researchers to find bugs, let us know about them for a long time now. And we've, you know, sometimes send people a t-shirt or recognize them on our public page. But in November of last year, we decided to actually offer financial rewards for people that let us know about bugs. And
you hear that, young hacklings? Go nuts. Google is telling you to go nuts.
Yeah, that's true. All of our web apps are in scope, and we have a lot of details on our page. We don't want people issuing denial of service attacks, and there's a couple of other...
Don't DDoS us, man. We're not going to give you money, right?
Exactly, exactly. But yeah, you got it right. First report, valid report in that gives us a chance to fix it before, you know, you blog about it or tweet about it. We have a panel that reviews all reports every week, and... yeah, we've given out a lot of money so far.
It was something like $215,000 as part of that program so far.
Yeah, about in the past 6 months. And there have been actually a number of individuals who make up a big proportion of that money. So they may actually be even getting more money than I am as an employee. But I think overall the program's been a big success.
$215,000, considering this is a program only launched around November last year, $215,000, I mean, that's, you're looking already at a run rate of about $430,000 a year in payouts to these guys. I'm wondering, in terms of value for money, do you guys feel that you're actually getting good QA for the money that you've spent?
So I don't think it's even distribution across the year. We actually have noticed a trailing off of money. But even so
people have maybe had a bit of a few bugs that they'd already done, and when you launched the program, they thought, sweet, I'll sell them, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten actually a trailing off of legitimate vulnerabilities more recently. There was a high influx when we started. But even so, I think it is actually still a really good value for the money. Google employs contractors, and I know how much contracting fees cost.
Hi, Mark.
and you have to, you know, you look at a program like this, and we're getting a lot more attention than what we're only paying out for real vulnerabilities. So overall, I think it's a great value for the money.
What sort of bugs are you talking about? I mean, what have you had some real clangers being submitted that you guys got submitted and just went, oh, okay, complete authentication bypass in Gmail. Thanks. Here's your $3,000.
I'm not going to get into the specific details.
That's a confirmation if ever I've heard it.
Yes, you can say that we've gotten a lot of really interesting bugs, a lot of really high impact bugs, and I mean, you know, I would love to say that ideally they weren't there in the first place, but it's awesome that we found out about them and fixed them. And yeah, there've been a lot of interesting and high impact bugs that have been reported.
Have you had other sites like Twitter, Facebook, you know, those massive online properties, have you had them getting in touch with you guys and expressing a bit of curiosity over the program?
Yeah, we have. And two of my colleagues, actually, Adam Main and Chris Evans, or Scary Beast, as he's known, actually gave a presentation, more a thorough presentation on the reward program at a conference a couple months ago. And other companies have definitely been interested in it. They went into the details of kind of what it takes to run a program like this in terms of resources. And you really need to have your house, I think, in pretty good shape as well for you to ask the public to hack on it too. Because we had a huge influx of reports, you know, not all of which were legitimate when we started, but they gave a good overview of kind of the real cost and how much effort it takes to run something like this, but definitely interest from other companies in the Bay Area and you know, in general online.
All right, well, Parisa Tabriz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Parisa Tabriz of Google there with a chat about Google's online bug bounty, among other things. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and this week's show is brought to you by Astaro, a company that has just been acquired by Sophos. It's big news, and I'm sure there's champagne corks popping over there at Astaro HQ. But we're not chatting about that today. Instead, we thought we'd get Astaro's Jack Daniel on the line and ask him about an age-old security dilemma. Should companies just kill off certain file types at their border? Should they allow things like Flash and PDF in their environment at all? Has Adobe stuff, for example, I mean, it could be another manufacturer's stuff, has Adobe stuff gotten so bad that, you know, companies should just block it from their environment altogether? He joined me to discuss.
A couple of things have changed in the past few years that have made it easier to take the question of what do you actually need versus what do you want seriously. And interestingly for me, one of the things that has been a problem for managing is mobile devices. But one of the beauties of, you know, the iPhone and iPad is that those of us who've said, you know, you really don't need all those applications on your Windows or Mac desktop. We've been told, no, we need everything. I have to have everything on my computer. And the same people that have been telling us that ran out and bought an iPad and discovered they can live without Flash. That's a great I told you so as an administrator to say, well, you know, if you're spending your own money for something that doesn't have Flash, why am I going to support it with the myriad of vulnerabilities, you know, the vulnerability a week drinking game with Adobe products?
Yeah. Well, it's funny though, isn't it? Because this is the tricky thing. Now, we can live without Flash and we can live without all of those bugs. I'd never heard that argument before, that the people with the iPads have all of a sudden gone, hey, you know, this isn't actually so bad. But the problem is if enough people start doing that, then the bad guys will start owning us through QuickTime, which is undoubtedly just as bad as Flash.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is incremental gain. And if we can make the bad guys move, then we make them move. Every little bit helps. And that's really where we have to go is, you know, the steps that we can take, especially in the small to mid-sized businesses, do what we can accomplish. And the classic requests that we've always made still apply, and they're starting to become more practical, partly because Microsoft is making it easier. But, you know, everybody does not need administrative access. Vista and Windows 7 have made it a little bit easier to run some things with reduced access. But, you know, when we get people, when I talk to people who have issues inside their network, we usually come back to, well, did you have up-to-date antivirus patterns on the desktop? Did you have, were they running as a local administrator? You know, have you patched anything on the computer lately? And the answers often come back to no. And so we loop back to you, do you really need Java? If you need Java, you need Java. But the number of times that you need Java is a lot less than it used to be.
So just backing up for a second, I mean, are you really suggesting that it's time that people remove Flash from their standard operating environment?
Maybe not from the standard operating environment, but if there are people that don't need it, if there are departments that don't need it, they don't need it.
But I think that was kind of the point that you were making earlier, right, which is that no one actually really needs Flash. You know, I mean, it is something right. that you could carve out of your standard build. People would whinge and bitch about it, but they'd get by.
Right. Absolutely. It really does depend on the environment, but in a lot of environments, you certainly can get away without Flash. The internet is broken without Flash. You get a lot of pages that are useless. But one of the upsides, not just giving me the argument if I'm the local administrator, of saying, well, you know, you plunk down how much money for all these I thingies that don't have Flash, so you can do without it on the company laptop. But the flip side is that there are all of these whatever devices that don't have Flash, which is driving more web developers to do things that at least function without a Flash player in them. So Flash is negotiable now, where it would have been a very hard sell even a year ago. Flash is certainly negotiable. If you do if you're a graphics firm, you're not going to be able to do it. If you do, you know, web development, you can't get rid of Flash. And it's hard to manage, too. It is not something that is, even though they're talking about doing it, it's not something that's you can manage through your Windows update systems, although they keep saying they're going to make that happen. It's just such a train wreck that if you can pull it out, do it. And it is becoming more possible to pull it out. I'm not saying the thing to do is then jam Silverlight on every Windows desktop.
yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, some of the other Adobe arguments. You can argue, you know, we can't function too well without a PDF reader of some sort. And using a PDF reader other than Adobe's doesn't make you safe. However, they have been less targeted, as to the best of our knowledge. So that, you know, you could make the argument that maybe one of the non-Adobe PDF readers moves you forward. But something like Flash or Silverlight, if you don't need them, they shouldn't be on there. Mm-hmm. Java.
Well, Java's a big one. I mean, you would have heard Adam Boileau often rue yes. the wide deployment of Java.
Right. And until recently, if you realized you were running an out-of-date version of Java, you went and grabbed the latest one and applied it, and then you'd look and see that you had 7 versions of Java on the box because it didn't scrape the old ones. You had to manually pull them out. So if you haven't kept those up to date, you could have several vulnerable versions. And I've encountered applications that require a specific version. In a past life, I remember one in particular that an auto manufacturer forced us to use to fix their cars. And it required one that if you had to reinstall a computer, you had to go through pages of Sun pages saying you really shouldn't use this. It's vulnerable and obsolete before we could install it. But that was what it took to fix those cars. So if you can get away with them, don't use them. And
so you're really saying here that if you can get away without using software that is known to be a target from the bad guys, I mean, switching to something that's a little bit more obscure, it's that whole security through obscurity model. I mean, it can actually be an effective layer is what you're saying. It can actually get you somewhere.
It can move you forward. It's not a panacea. It's not going to solve all your problems, but we have enough of a challenge that moving forward a little bit is moving forward. I mean, we've had for years, you know, the hardening guides, and we sometimes were good and applied them to our servers, and sometimes we were good and, you know, put them on desktops and very sensitive areas, or sometimes said we did. But we really don't have to go to that full 80-page hardening guide thing to step back a little and say, well, you know, we don't need Flash in this environment. We don't need Winamp in this environment. We don't need these things. It makes the systems more reliable. Just forget the security. The more, you know, the less crap you throw on a Windows machine, the longer it lasts, just from a stability and reliability point. The security stuff's almost a bonus.
Now, you know, we were talking before about users who used to love to run 6 million apps on their work computers, you know, and increasingly there's this trend for organizations to allow people in with their own devices, whether that's an iPad or a laptop or a whatever. Is there something to be said for people bringing in purely personal devices that can maybe even go onto a different DMZ Wi-Fi network at work, and they can play Angry Birds and they can get on Facebook and they can do all of that shit just through a clean, unfiltered, considered dirty, unclean Wi-Fi connection? Do you think we're going to start seeing approaches like that? Because I can understand that if you really lock down an SOE in your work network and you make it, you know, seriously restricted, you'll get a lot of user resistance. But if you say to them, hey, bring your laptop in, you can get it on the Wi-Fi on this like staff fun Wi-Fi connection, and you can run whatever applications you want. You can have any screensaver virus you care to download. Go for it. Just don't let any work data touch that box. I mean, that's a nice, simple rule. I can kind of see stuff like that working. What do you think?
Yeah, the trick is that there will be some crossover. They're going to try to use their personal email client for company email or other things that could become sensitive. So you have to take that into consideration. But that's absolutely an approach to really lock down the work environment and have a more relaxed. How relaxed depends on where you are. You know, maybe you still do want to filter for pornography or known malicious sites, or do some rudimentary filtering on it, or maybe do some thorough filtering, but definitely segregate it. We do that. When I bring my personal laptop into the office, I jump on a guest network, which has a different rule set and has restricted access. I can't get to the internal devices. So if I fire up my work laptop, I am on the domain, I'm authenticated, and I have access to internal resources. If I fire up my personal laptop, I have access to some things, but a lot of the intranet stuff is off limits to me, unless I create a VPN tunnel in, and then I go through a set of extra layers of authentication and inspection to get to that data. It's not a burden to do it that way once you get used to it and realize, you know, there's a trade-off here. I can do whatever I want here, or almost whatever I want here. I can get my job done, which is critical, because at some point in time, we still have to remember that people are trying to accomplish some bit of work between playing Angry Birds sessions. It's certainly a viable approach to split these networks. Network segmentation is always is usually a good idea.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I remember many, many years ago seeing a product made by a defense firm called 10X. They made a thing called a data diode. You know, it was like a network separation product that was actually pretty cool. It used a, you know, this optical device that would allow you to transfer data via a UDP spray across an optical sensor, so it could only be one way. So the idea was you got people working on classified networks, and, you know, they can take data from, you know, an untrusted network and shunt it into a trusted network, but nothing can come back the other way. In theory, unless there was deliberate user interference, right? So it was a pretty interesting product. But I'm wondering if there's a market for network separation products that can be used to switch between low security and just increased security environments. So not necessarily a network that doesn't have any outside access at all, but perhaps a much stricter set of rules on how that outside access is achieved. And then you can flip over into like a bit of a grubbier network to engage in your sort of more risky internet behavior. I mean, I wonder if we're going to get to that sort of point eventually as well, if that's actually going to be a practical approach.
I think it does make sense to head in that direction, the segmentation of not necessarily the full lockdown DMZ, but different levels of access. I mean, the same thing that we do with user accounts have different levels of access to resources within the domain. At the network level, the ability to provide some level of segmentation and isolation and, restrict where we can and allow access where we can. And it can be done fairly easily with a lot of extending our last conversation, talking about using things that we used to use as frontline defenses, such as firewalls, to bring in some of this network segmentation and apply some of the rules so that we have different rule sets and we can protect what we need to protect.
Well, what I really liked about that 10X device is that it was a box with a button on it. So the user, the operator, didn't really have to know much apart from if I push that button, it'll flip over to this screen. It all used thin client and stuff. So if I push that button once, you know, I'm in the secure environment. If I push it again, I'm in the insecure environment. And it was really that simple to use. And I just wonder if stuff like that's going to get adopted en masse. Probably not, I mean, just yet, because it's so expensive. But, you know, it's interesting. And I wonder if we're going to see more out of the box approaches like that.
It is interesting. And one of the keys to something like that, as you said, is it's simplicity for the end user. And as much fun as it is to make fun of the end users, we do, I mean, there are people that are trying to do their jobs, whatever their jobs are. We need to, if not enable them or empower them or whatever buzzword we want to use, we need to get out of their way and not be an excuse for them not performing whatever it is that brings income into the corporation or organization. And so things like that can be done painlessly or relatively painlessly are a good idea.
So we could see a situation in the future where we effectively have, you know, twin SOEs. You got your play environment and your work environment where you're using a browser with like no plugins. You know, you're basically using it for email and working on work serious business stuff. And then, you know, if you want to diddle around and read some news on the web, you know, you flip over to your browsing environment or something.
It's doable. I mean, for example, I have, because I'm on the road a lot, I have a Windows Server 2008 R2 hard drive that I pop into one of my laptops for some lab sessions and some things that I do. If you ever, you can use it as a desktop OS, but it'll drive you stark raving mad. I mean, Internet Explorer is completely locked down. The Internet's broken because it's built as a server operating system. And, you know, as much fun as it is to kick Microsoft, they really have learned a lot and moved a long way. And if you get to Server 2008 R2, that is a pretty well locked down box. And it if you step back, it does what you need it to do. You just can't, you know, you can't surf a lot of things on the internet. You can get out there and grab a patch or two, and that's about it. And there is a reason for that. It's because the servers have been hammered so much that they finally locked them down. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say we need to look at where we can take those sort of steps with the user desktop and protect ourselves, protect our systems, protect our customers' data.
All right. Well, Jack Daniel, thank you so much for joining us for a bit of a discussion around SOEs and I guess double SOEs.
Great. It was good talking to you as always. Thank you very much.
Jack Daniel from our sponsor Astaro there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to IT Web for flying me here to South Africa and for taking such good care of me. To Charles van der Walt, who gave up some of his own time to show me around Cape Town last weekend. To Multigo creator Rulof Temming and his cohort Andrew for hanging out with me here in Joburg. To Haroon Mir for the awesome political argument we had at Nando's. And, you know, just to everyone here who helped me out and made this just such a wonderful trip. I've had such an awesome time here. This week's track is a little bit out of the ordinary. I did a talk here about the militarization of digital security, and I spoke a little bit in that talk about Werner von Braun. He was a Nazi rocket scientist who was relocated to the United States after World War II to continue rocket development. American satirist Tom Lehrer wrote this song about him and his story. It's pretty funny, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to RB2 to check out all of our AusCert coverage. So head over to risky.biz/AusCert just to get all of the blog posts and the audio, or go to risky.biz/feeds to subscribe to the RB2 feed. See you later.
Gather round while I sing you of Werner von Braun, a man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience. Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Werner von Braun. Don't say that he's hypocritical, say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Werner von Braun. Some have harsh words for this man of renown, but some think our attitude should be one of gratitude, like the widows and cripples in old London town, who owe their large pensions to Werner von Braun. You too may be a big hero, once you've learned to count backwards to zero. In German or English, I know how to count down. And I'm learning Chinese, says Werner von Braun.
But first up, it's time for the check. I started off by asking her to tell us... I started off by asking Parisa to... I started... Companies should just block it from the metric grade. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to... Okay, so this week's podcast is a mess and I've been slurring my words. Because of the following people. Say your name, state your name and position, please.
Rulof Temming, Paterva, Hack the Planet.
Andrew McPherson, Paterva, Hack the Planet.
Sue Atfield, Dance Hub, Hack the Planet!
Christoph Breitenbach, I don't know if I want to hack the planet, but all
the planet.
Peace to
hack
everyone.
Hack the planet!
Charles van der Walt, a closet Pilates instructor. Hack the planet!
Claustrophobic!